In this episode, you'll discover how long a video should be, and I'll explain what you need to know about the fake news controversy.
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery. Brought to you by Wirebuzz.
What is up? All right, great to be behind the mic and to give you the latest episode of Video Marketing Mastery. You know, in a moment, you're going to find out how long a video should be. And I'll give you my really unique media insider perspective on fake news. But before I get to all that, before I get to the latest news that matters to video marketing masteries, let's answer a couple questions that I received from people like you in the audience this week. The first one says, "Hey Todd, listening to your episode 49 got me thinking about a question I had for you. Can you answer this for me? What would be examples of videos for each stage of the buyer's journey?" Okay, super smart question. I'm glad you asked. That tells me that as an audience member, you're starting to put together the big building blocks, right? And if you think about a buyer's journey, before I answer this question, let me just back up for listeners. When you think about a buyer's journey goes from left to right, okay? It is the marketer's version of a sales funnel. You know, a sales funnel is kind of like, for those of you who went to college or were blessed with a high school that had a really good social environment, a sales funnel is like the top of a beer bong, right? And at the very top of it, it's wide. And as it starts to work its way down the sales funnel, people that were originally prospects start falling through, and at the bottom, they become customers, okay? And a marketer's journey and a sales funnel are virtually the same thing, except salespeople look through a funnel top to bottom, marketers look left to right, all right? So you can pretty much apply this question to a sales funnel also. There are three stages in a marketer's buyer's journey. The first stage is awareness stage. Then there's consideration, and then there's decision stage. Let's start with awareness. We're going to look left to right. The types of videos that are appropriate for the awareness stage. Remember, awareness is when people are on Google and they're like typing in something. They're exercising demand for information. They don't even know about your product yet. They don't even know your product exists yet. In fact, they don't even care about your product yet. What they're doing is they're exercising demand for information. And demand is the most important word when you're trying to create content in the awareness stage. What you want to do is supply the frequently asked questions that your target prospect is demanding when they exercise demand on search. Got it? Those are like tutorials on how to do something. They're storytelling videos or even viral videos. I look at them like frequently asked questions that your target prospect asks you in the first meeting or the first email, okay? And for me, those are like, how do I boost my search results? Or how do I get people to buy my product quicker, right? Or remember, people don't ever approach me and say, "Todd, we need video." Well, now they do, I guess. And now that happens more common. But when I started this company way back in the day where really nobody knew they needed video, they really came up with me with questions that had to do with search or social or email or sales or thought leadership. And then as I answered those questions, I started to introduce them to video. Now, once I start introducing them to my product, like you, when you start introducing your product, you really enter the next stage, which is called consideration. Remember, there are three stages: awareness, consideration, and decision stage, right? Going left to right. In the consideration stage, you start to talk about maybe your company overview video or an explainer video about your company and the solutions you provide. You might even have a case study, right? Because now they're starting to consider you. You've already demonstrated superior knowledge in the topic in the awareness stage, right? And now you've transitioned them where they're looking at you, they're considering you. So a company overview, an explainer video, case studies are brilliant in consideration stage. I use them all the time. and even product features fit into the consideration stage. The final stage, decision stage, when you guessed it, they're making a decision, that's where testimonials fit in. Now, if you really want to get technical and nerdy, I'll tell you that testimonials fit in both consideration and decision stage, but for the sake of keeping your lines very clean, let's say testimonial videos fit in decision stage. Pricing overview videos are in that decision stage. Pricing overview videos, by the way, are frigging brilliant when you're lead scoring. Because if somebody's going to look at that pricing overview, they're actually past consideration and now they're looking with their budget to see if you're a good fit, right? So if you track and lead score individual prospects in your CRM, you want to do it on videos that and have greater lead score to videos that are further down the buyer's journey. Make sense? Then product comparison is in the decision stage. It's a product comparison video. Remember, people don't read anymore. Objection handle videos that your sales team uses to move somebody who might be stalling out on an objection, that fits in the decision stage. Frequently asked questions about your product or service are in the decision stage, which are different than the frequently asked questions that I mentioned earlier in the awareness stage, right? The awareness stage are frequently asked questions when people are starting to exercise interest in the broader topic. And then in decision stage, the last one that I commonly see would be product training, which is like, hey, how to open up your account and set up your credit card, or how to connect your email account if you're a SaaS service, how to connect your bulk email to your CRM in a video, right? Like that is a decision stage product training video, and it works very, very well. I hope that answered your question in a very good, compelling, strategic way so you can start laying out your buyer's journey and generating revenue at faster and faster rates like we've done for our clients and like we've done for us. Now, I want to give you a little bit of case study here to explain how the buyer's journey has benefited me and also for our clients. But let me tell you mine really quickly. In 2016, Wirebuzz has had 33% less salespeople. Normally, in any business, any traditional business, that would affect the bottom line, right? Maybe business would go down by 33%. But because we strategically used video through the buyer's journey and we sped up our sales process, and we sped it up because people don't want to read. They're too lazy to read. And they learn significantly faster from video. By adding video strategically through that buyer's journey, we sped up the sales process. Instead of it taking 8 weeks, it now takes 3 weeks to get a deal done. So even though we've got 33% less salespeople right now, we're doing 60% more revenue, okay? So think about your business, open up all the drawers and look into your process, right? And see where things are stalling out and lay video through that path. And the decision-making process will happen so much faster that your company will have the problem that I have right now, which I probably have more leads than people that can help me write up deals, okay? That is different than where we were a year ago, and you should have that same luck. Use video, you'll speed up the process, generate more revenue, and you'll have a good problem like I have right now. All right, so Christo just came up with a great idea for what we could put that would be a valuable resource for you on wirebuzz.com/52. Christo, tell us about it.
Well, kind of a rite of passage for everybody here at Wirebuzz is we've got to go through the HubSpot training, and it's actually free to anybody out there who's looking to learn about inbound marketing can access the training tools that they offer. And part of that is some information on what the buyer's journey is and how to use it as a smart marketer. So we'll link to that resource in the show notes, and feel free, check it out, take the test after you learn and watch all the cool videos.
Right on. I'm glad you brought that up, Christo. It's really interesting. HubSpot, which you might have heard from a past episode or maybe three past episodes on this podcast, HubSpot provides three training certification courses. Actually came up the other day at lunch. Somebody was asking me about it. And the first one is called inbound training. That's the one that Christo and I are recommending that you go through. And it's a quick course. It'll be on wirebuzz.com/52. Easy way to remember 52 is it's the number worn by Pittsburgh Steeler Hall of Famer Mike Webster, who I think recently passed and had a very challenging life with football-related injuries. And so, anyway, Mike Webster, total beast, Pittsburgh Steeler, wirebuzz.com/52, where you'll get that information. And you'll notice that HubSpot's certification program for you know, their audience is all done in video. Yeah, you can download the text, but it's all done in video because they already know. In order to get more people to learn about their certification program and to get more people to go through the process, they're going to get better results using video. And every time I see the HubSpot guys, I always mention to them that it's rather obvious and telling that HubSpot recognizes that the power of video is the way to go, because even the big dogs of inbound marketing leverage it to their success. It's a free course. Everybody here in the company uses it. Wirebuzz.com/52. Also, I received another question and they said, Todd, would you give your basic pitch in video marketing for any small business owner? Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I do that all day long. And I usually start off two ways. I try to be more nimble than set in my ways. And so I'm going to give you my two paths, basically. If they come to me saying they need video, I tend to take the path of, well, what business problem are you trying to solve? And it's a little disarming, because mostly when people want video, they're like, well, I just need a video. And I want to take a step back and talk to them about how that video is going to impact business. Because I know that at the end of the day, my proposal is going to be evaluated by three letters, ROI in that order, right? What's the return on investment that they're going to get? So if they've got a business problem, so the business problem could be, Todd, we want to advance our search and optimize our search. Well, video gets the best search results, right? Or Todd, we want to make sure that we're selling more. Well, people are 144% more likely to buy after watching a video. So I know this, the flow path. So when I understand what their business problem is, then I can flow them through the conversation of, people are four times more likely to watch video. People are three times more likely to share it inside of their office than any other type of content. And as a result, people learn quicker with video and buy faster with video. Okay. That's kind of the general approach. And then I like to show them my case studies of how I've built very large audiences on social with video and how I convert faster deals with video. And I kind of walk them through that. Now, every business is going to be a little bit different. I suspect that the person asking this is also a video marketer. So you've got to kind of finesse your way through it, but the big picture is spend more time asking questions when you start pitching. Learn, listen. They're going to drop all the signals and then tailor, as an expert would, your feedback based on what their interest and needs are. Does that make sense? All right. In real news, not fake news, we'll get to fake news in a moment, but in real news, GoPro says bye-bye to 15% of its workers and also cuts its entertainment division. Now, GoPro, the sports action camera maker that surged in popularity due to the entertainment value of its really innovative flagship product, is admitting that it needs to do more than just entertain masses, right? And this week, GoPro said it was going to cut 15% of its workforce, or that equates to 200 plus jobs. They're going to cancel current open positions and close down their entertainment division. Now, I would say, as a spectator, you know, GoPro's really had some interesting boom times for a revolutionary product that changed the way that video's created, and also how video creators go out and explore and be a part of their outdoor life activities and share that video with their audiences. historically, GoPros had really impressive marketing initiatives like contests, sponsorships, strong digital presence. They also are a company that skyrocketed on the back of a really kick-ass product, a cool attitude, but I think they grew way too fast for sustainability. There's a great book out there about the lean startup. I think that's what the title is. It would be helpful for anybody that is looking to run a lean and mean startup and not get too far out in front of their skis that they're going to crash when the conditions change. And GoPro also introduced a lot of waste and excess within the company. That's what happens when things start going great. When things start going great inside of a company, that's when people start making irrational decisions. So to give you an idea, it's a lot like going out drinking. You got a ton of money coming in. As more money comes in, you start really believing the bullshit that you're telling yourself, just like when you're drinking, and you start buying things that may not be necessary for critical mission impact. And GoPro experienced that. And, you know, pairing with the lackluster, underwhelming products that they've passed out over the couple of years, they've taken huge losses, and trying to sustain their size, their momentum, was really difficult when they started rolling out less than stellar products. Now, it's inevitable that they'd need to downsize, and at some point, given their track record, that day of reckoning came this week. You know, I'd say that as a spectator, GoPro definitely seemed like a company that was struggling with its identity over the last couple of years. Sure, they were rolling out really cool cameras with really nice resolution that could take a beating. But they started coming out with multiple different SKUs of products that had really slight differences. As an entrepreneur, that should be ringing a bell to you when your business starts doing that, because it's a waste of resources. It doesn't have enough distinction. And it wasn't until they released their current line of products that they really cut down and narrowed their focus on the number of products that they have to offer. Now, GoPro has products like the Session, Hero 5, and Karma, and all have clearly distinct different capabilities. Now, the big issue now is that, you know, GoPro rushed their Karma, it's their drone, to the market, and as a result, had to recall the device. And it's had a really hard time failing it mid-flight. That's a big problem. And so companies grow fast, will deal with quality assurance product problems along the way, and we're witnessing with GoPro. Big picture, huge fan. In this company, Crystal, what do you think? There might be 6-10 GoPros floating around, but when we bought our drone, we didn't go with a Karma. And thankfully, our drone doesn't fail mid-flight, right? All right, and more fake news. No, I'm sorry. This is real news. It's so hard to keep these things straight nowadays. Fake news, new news. Justin Bieber said this week he's 99% sure Instagram is for the devil. I'll let you figure out if that's real news or fake news, but he really did say it. Just don't know if we can get a quote for the devil on this episode. No devil replied when we submitted for requests to be interviewed, so I'll consider it real news that just sounds like fake news. Do you remember in a past episode, I told you how YouTube was working to engage new members in developing nations that have limited 3G or 4G cellular access by creating an app that enabled users to download videos from Wi-Fi, like let's say at their office or at home, that they can, with this app, watch later on? That's how they're baby stepping into new markets with giant populations like India. Well, the Mercury News reports Facebook has gone live in India with a service called Express Wi-Fi, and they plan to expand to other regions soon. It's kind of like their testing ground. Express Wi-Fi empowers local entrepreneurs to help provide quality internet access to their neighbors and to make some steady income. The company said on the website, quote, "Working with local internet service providers or mobile operators, they're able to use software provided by Facebook to connect communities." Now, this is a really cool story. It should be an important lesson for entrepreneurs. You see, most of us would see India's low access to 3G or 4G Wi-Fi, or excuse me, cellular access, as a sign that we should probably come back in 3 years or 4 years when the country's infrastructure and internet accessibility has been figured out, right? But YouTube and Facebook, they look at India's 1.25 billion citizens as their next expandable territory, and it's a huge opportunity. India is an opportunity that they just couldn't miss out on. And just like digital marketing opportunities, early adopters get the largest ROI, largest market share, largest adoption. And while most of us entrepreneurs are afraid to fail, the early bird always gets the worm. In a minute, I'm going to respond to a question that came up this week from Bob, who asked, I keep hearing that shorter videos get better results. Can you help me make sense of this, Todd? So that's going to come up in a few moments. I also saw in the news that in the last 2 months, ESPN has lost 1,176,000 subscribers. A subscriber lost nearly the size of the city of Dallas, Texas in the last 2 months from ESPN. Now, in fairness, ESPN's contested the subscriber estimates that Nielsen has announced, but they cited omissions and multiple factors, including streaming services and digital service numbers. However, if the Nielsen numbers are even remotely close to a true subscriber loss number for ESPN, it means ESPN has lost hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue over the last 3 years alone. And if this trend continues, ESPN is in big time trouble and well on its way to collapse. Now, as a business owner, I think it's important to always be adjusting to market signals. And the biggest market signal that we see for networks right now is their audiences are shifting, they're cutting the cord, they're moving away from televisions and going to a second device. And you have to then adjust and pivot your revenue streams and your businesses in order to be able to stay afloat. In my wallet, I have my Blockbuster card that I used to rock every Friday and Saturday night with my wife, hot date night to Blockbuster, walk down the aisle, pick out a date movie, some romance movie, a chick flick, never an action movie, you get it. And I would go into that store, a freestanding brick and mortar building, and we would pick out a movie, maybe some licorice before we knew we had gluten problems, and we would go home and have a date night with Blockbuster in front of our TV. But that shit changed. And overnight, Blockbuster didn't adjust at all. And the reason I have it in my wallet, and every time I reach in to hand somebody my business card, my hand actually in the same slot touches my Blockbuster card, because I want to be reminded, and I hope you do too, how rapidly business changes. And in order for your business to sustain, to grow, to profit, and for you to keep your employees, you've got to be willing to look at other opportunities that are developing in your industry. The early bird gets the worm. Blockbuster missed it. Netflix gained it. And now all of us are $12 a month Netflix subscribers, or we're poaching in on somebody else in our family who is. Think about how the market adjusts in your industry. Test in developing trends, because all of the digital memory cards here at Wirebuzz for all of our cameras, and I tell you, I never stop buying new ones with larger capabilities for our crew that's on the road all the time. All of them have names that do not belong to the big dogs of photography. Kodak, Polaroid, Fuji is not on those memory cards, right? Why? Because they got fat and lazy like Blockbuster. They missed the curve. They didn't see the developing trend in their industry, and they gave it to somebody else. Be nimble, my friends. And as such, you'll be able to retain employees, grow, and your original investment will continue to work in your favor. And to me, and that's how in a rapidly evolving economy with technology, the rich doesn't get richer and the poor doesn't get poorer. Because the rich in these contexts that I just shared was Blockbuster, Kodak, Fuji, and they missed it because they got fat and lazy. And the poor out-hustled and outworked, and they became the new dogs of digital technology, the Netflix, the the people that are on our memory cards. I can't think of their names, but I send them a ton of money. But those are the ones that out-hustled the rich that were on vacation while the poor made it happen. All right, if you want to see any of these news stories, just go to wirebuzz.com/52. That's where those stories are going to be linked from. And I want to spend some time talking about fake news. When I'm done with fake news, we're going to segue into what will be ultimately the episode, which is, hey, how long should a video be, Todd? And I'm going to explain the right way to answer that question. All right, so have you heard about the fake news campaign? You know, as a longtime member of the media, I have a pretty unique insider view of this topic, especially because I'm just not susceptible to groupthink at all. It's never worked on me. And, you know, I'm not saying that you are. I'm just saying that you're, you know, I'm not saying you're susceptible to groupthink or that you're sheep. I'm not doing that. I'm just saying I've had this really weird life of being in the media, and sniffing out BS and fake stories and all this stuff has just come really intuitive to me. And well, TechCrunch reports, while it would have been nice to tackle this issue before the election, Google and Facebook are finally taking a tiny step in order to fight back against fake news. Now, according to multiple statements, both companies have updated their policies to ban fake news sites from using Facebook's and Google's advertising networks. Now, all that's totally fine with me, right? If you're posting fake news, you shouldn't be able to profit from it. And I know there's sites like AJ Plus that profits off of fake news, and you're not going to get an argument from me on that. Google updated its policy saying that the company will try to ban sites in Google that misrepresent, misstate, or conceal information, right? That's a direct quote. Websites who don't comply with this rule get banned from Google AdSense. Now, again, totally reasonable for me. And who could be opposed to banning websites that misrepresent or conceal information, right? Not me. And the reason I say not me is I'm not beholden to any party. Like, I don't care if somebody's got an R or a D after their name. I don't care if they're a Republican or a Democrat, or if somebody wins the election over somebody else. I don't care. What I'm interested in is truth. And for me, as a former investigative news reporter, the easiest way to sum up truth is like looking at a glass of champagne. Okay. Truth is the bubble that is attached to the bottom of the champagne glass. And if you've ever had champagne before and you look deep into that glass, eventually truth will bubble up to the surface, right? And there's a really fabulous way that the market, individuals making consumer decisions, end up isolating news that isn't real or isn't believable or is too conspiracy theorist. It's some magic hand of the marketplace. I'm cool with all of that. And by removing potential revenue streams, you know, it makes sense that businesses that provide fake news be less lucrative. Okay, all that makes sense. You know, for instance, BuzzFeed discovered that more than 100 fake news sites were created in a tiny city in Macedonia. So, you know, it's clear that it's not just about influencing elections. People are taking advantage of the social networks and making money by creating fake news. You, me, my mother, we should all be opposed to that. Now, on the surface level, all this makes sense. But as I've witnessed in my years of being in the news, when the powerful feels threatened, when the established structure feels threatened by maybe incoming new competition, they never miss an opportunity of taking advantage of a crisis to also take care of, well, not only the crisis, but let's clean up our enemies or even our competition at the same time, okay? It's like the front exterior of the topic is about cleaning up fake news. But behind the scenes, when nobody's looking, we're also going to knock down our competitors, okay? I see this all the time, and it is literally at this point in my life where I just can't handle it anymore, because all of us are operating, I believe, out of good intentions. We all want to be good people. We want to make our world a better place so we can pass it on to our kids, our grandchildren. In my case, so I can pass it on to my puppy, a better world. I get it, right? So on the surface level, all that makes sense. The Mercury News reports Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said on Friday that the tech firm is exploring ways to combat fake news on their site after the company faced mounting criticism that they aren't doing enough to prevent misinformation from going viral. All right. Quote, "We've been working on this problem for a long time and we take the responsibility seriously," the big Zuck Mark Zuckerberg wrote in a Facebook post on this topic. Quote, "We've made significant progress, but there's more work to be done." Now, the article goes on to say that some people blame Facebook for Donald Trump's presidential victory because fake election stories circulated on the site and the company curates information and shows it to 1.7 billion users. Remember, 1.7 billion users are not American voters. It was 120 million American voters that were part of the decision-making process. So just understanding the numbers, and that these people get news from Facebook's news feed, and Facebook's thinking about creating a filtered bubble or an echo chamber that helps protect from this information. Now, Zuckerberg said earlier that he thought the idea that Facebook influenced the outcome of the election is, quote, "a pretty crazy idea," end quote, noting that less than 1%, get that, less than 1% of the news on Facebook is fake. Now, is this really about 1% of the news being fake? Is Zuck and the president of the United States and the established mainstream traditional media really crusading to clean up 1% of the news because it's fake? And that 1% of the news swayed an election? Is that what this is really about? Because my journalistic spider senses are tingling because something doesn't make sense. And I've gotten myself in this last week in plenty of discussions with people that are really feeling like this is a huge issue for mankind that needs to be cleared up. So do you think it's strange how quickly the mainstream media and Facebook and Google all got onto the same talking points about removing fake news right after the election? I mean, that's just not how problems saturate public consciousness and organically work through our system of, oh, this is a developing problem that needs to be addressed. It was like all these people showed up. I literally went to bed and fake news wasn't a problem. And I woke up the next day and there was this high-powered marketing initiative behind fake news. Stuff just doesn't work that way. And, you know, that's how the power brokers push a much larger issue together. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't even own a single tinfoil hat, right? I don't believe that aliens live in Area 51. I believe that gold exists at Fort Knox. You know, I think man actually went to the moon and we didn't create it in Hollywood, though I grew up in Los Angeles and I can see where Hollywood could pull it off, but I don't believe that. As a former member of the media, I think I need to tell you that everything that I saw and everything that I'm seeing now in one way or another is absolutely fake news. It's why I got out of it. I wanted nothing to do with it. It's all a bunch of bullshit right now. And this is nothing new. It happens every day in every election. It happens in every publication. And I'm super jaded. Let's just spend a few moments. Walk down memory lane with me. I want to share with you why I don't believe in groupthink, why I don't believe that fake news is this new phenomenon. And I also don't think that this Zuckerberg, Facebook, Google, mainstream media initiative to clean up 1% of news is the real story, which puts me out there in this like whack job fringe group. So let me give you a little bit of my background. I want to give you some of these really interesting stories in my life that have shaped my perspective. I know you're going to find them interesting because I'm super jaded about prepackaged messages. You know, when I was growing up in Los Angeles in the 1980s, when I showed up at T-ball, my T-ball Little League coach, my dad was the assistant coach, my T-ball Little League coach, random selection was Tito Jackson of the Jackson 5. Okay. I know in LA, this kind of weird stuff happens all the time, and it happened to me. And I knew everyone in the Jackson family. My family hit it off with theirs. Tito and my dad coached together for 4 years. His kids and I were best friends. And on our arm patch, on our jersey, said, you know, where everybody says like sponsored by Perry's Pizza or, you know, something like that, a local business. Our arm patch said sponsored by the Jackson 5. Get on, girl, right? Like, how awesome is the Jackson 5 sponsoring your Little League team? But it happened to me. And because the Jacksons were performers, there were times where they weren't on the road or they weren't recording. And you know what the brothers of the Jackson 5 did? They came to every practice and every game. No exaggeration. Even Janet LaToya, even Michael's creepy parents, who weren't creepy, would be there at our Little League games and practices because Tito's kids were the first grandchildren and everybody, all of them lived within like 1 mile of Little League. So in my years, my 4 years of going on vacation and our families doing things together, I spent time with every member of the Jackson family. I went to concerts with them. I spent the night at their house. I never met Michael, not a single time, except when we went backstage at a Jackson concert, but just in passing. But this is where I get you to prepackaged messages, okay? Because in the dugout, remember, there were so many fans of the Jackson 5 that in the dugout, the brothers would sit in the dugout to keep away from fans or the media, and they would have business conversations while we were at practice. By the way, I was at practice the day that Tito found out that Michael's hair was on fire from the Pepsi commercial, right? So to give you a little context. But in the dugout, the conversation between the brothers, the most famous brothers, the most famous band in the world at that time, would be about Michael. Michael was ostracized. And the conversations would be like, who the hell does he think he is? I mean, they have heated conversations. This isn't Michael Jackson and the Jackson 4. This is the Jackson 5, right? And this is right when Michael was starting to break away. Michael was breaking away. But if you drove 1 mile away from our Little League field, there's a billboard on Ventura Boulevard right above Tower Records of the Jackson 5 and their new album, right? Prepackaged message, Jackson 5. They're all good. They got a new album coming. But inside that dugout, who the hell does he think he is? This isn't Michael Jackson and the Jackson 4. So I'm jaded, okay? Because I've been inside those conversations and I've heard what really happens and then what gets portrayed out to the public. It is always different. Hey, by the way, if you want to see a photo of my Little League team and our rockin' Dodger jerseys with the Jackson 5 sponsor, just go to wirebuzz.com/52. I'll put that photo up. And when you see, you'll see Tito in there and Tito's kids, but you'll also see me. You'll identify Todd. I am on the left side of the photo, bottom row, far left, standing underneath my dad, who is the assistant coach, right? And when I was on location as a national media journalist, I watched fake news every single day. So this is nothing new. You know, when Clear Channel had me in Florida in the 2000 presidential election, covering the presidential recount, all I saw every day, packaged to you and your family on your televisions, was fake news. Give you an example, all right? Let this be a lesson about the way the media bullshits. And when I showed up in Tallahassee, Florida, at the state capitol as a reporter, I remember walking on location and I saw all the TV before. People like I in rage on the streets demanding that their ballots be counted. And I actually expected when I got there, when I walked past four blocks, continuous blocks of media trucks, to get into the center, to almost be experiencing a riot. I was a bit scared. The person I was with, we talked about where we'd meet if things got a little hairy, okay? And so when I walked out onto the scene, there was nobody there. It was just media, people walking around with badges. And one guy walked by and he handed me a press release, bam, into my hand. And I looked at the press release and it said, spontaneous protest erupts in Florida tomorrow at 12:30. And I read down and it said, voters from all over Florida are spontaneously coming to the state capitol to demand that their voice is heard and their ballots are counted 12:30 tomorrow. Basically be there, be square, right? So I was like, that's kind of cool. There's going to be a protest tomorrow. Maybe all these people are going to show up, right? And that night, we went to the only bar that was walking distance from the state capitol. I don't remember the name, but I remember the inside when I walked in vividly, because at every table was CNN, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, the alphabet soups were there, Fox News, you name it. It was like, I looked around, I was like, those are all these rock star media people, these news guys, right? And they were all talking and having a good time. And the news would come on. And then they'd turn to the news and it was Larry King and they'd stop their conversations. A hush would come over the crowd. They start taking notes off of the TV, right? It was bizarre. Every seat was taken except at the bar. So I sat at the bar with my colleague. My colleague said to the bartender, hey, look, what's going on inside that? What's going inside that in the kitchen behind the bar? What's going on in there? This is like, our show ended at 7 o'clock on the West Coast. So it must've been like 10 o'clock or 10:30 in the evening. And there was workers, like 15 workers in the kitchen that we could see and that were working. And my buddy said to the bartender, hey, what's going on in there? And he goes, oh, we got this really cool contract to do the lunches for the protest tomorrow. And I reached into my jacket and I pulled out this press release. And it's a spontaneous protesters from all over Florida come to, right? And I said, do you mean this spontaneous protest? And the guy goes, yeah, we're making 3,000 lunches, sandwiches, apples, chips, and juice, right? And we're like, well, that's kind of cool. I mean, never heard of spontaneous protesters having lunch ready for them. And, you know, because I'm now cynical. So my friend said, wow, that's a hell of a contract. Who paid for it, right? And the guy goes, oh, the company across the street, literally pointed across the street. It was maybe 20 feet from us. And we were like, you mean that company? And he goes, yeah. And it said on the door, AFL-CIO, right? Biggest union in the country, paid for the sandwiches. So we thought, hey, that's kind of interesting. Okay. We'll think about it. The next day, I had an 11 a.m. interview with Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was there to speak at the spontaneous protest. It went all over Clear Channel. And then we were like, well, where are all these people? Nobody showed up yet. It's a weird spontaneous protest. And you know what happened? Nobody was there at 12. And at 12:10, it was a ghost town. It was just media people standing around waiting for a show to happen. And then at 12:15, like clockwork, a school bus pulled up, followed by 75 other school buses. We're like, damn, I mean, this is an event. And you know what? People came out of the school buses with the white boxes we saw from the night before that were being made. And they had t-shirts that said, every vote should count, right? And signs. And they came out and they stood in front of the Supreme Court building. I kid you not. And they marched back and forth 15 times. Every vote should count. Every, right? We're like, that's kind of, then when the media got their footage, the people walked three blocks to the state capitol and put on the same charade. And as the buses pulled away, I pointed to my partner and I go, the license plate says Alabama. The next one said Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, right? We were like, damn, they got buses from all over the place. My partner goes, hey, let's start asking people where they're from. Because this press release says all over Florida, right? So we started walking with the crowd and we have audio of all of this. Hey, how long did it take for you to get down into Florida today, right? And people were like, oh, I'm here from Mississippi. They told me I'd get the day off free for work if I came down here and protested so people get their vote counted. And we're like, you're from Mississippi. I spoke to the next lady. Where are you from? I came from Alabama. I don't even want to be here. I just got a free day off of work. I really want to be there when my kids get off of school so I could help them get into the house safe. But they told me I had to be here. So I drove 12 hours in this stupid bus. We had all this audio. It was a gift from the gods, right? And we follow them, and they went to the protest, and Jesse Jackson spoke, keep hope alive, you're going to get your votes counted. And, you know, all this made up movie extra bullshit, right? So that day, the Supreme Court ruled who the next president was going to be, and it got confirmed by the Capitol there in Florida. And I jumped on an airplane, and to go from Tallahassee to Phoenix, you got to be on four airplanes because there just isn't a Tallahassee to Phoenix route. And at every airport, I picked up every newspaper I could get my hands on. And do you know what the news was saying? Like a media echo chamber of people who can't think straight and can't report honest news. Every newspaper, disenfranchised voters from all over Florida have embarked to get their votes counted. Crap, crap, crap. Everything is fake news. So don't tell me that Zuck is trying to clean up 1% of the news when it's all crap. The recount in Florida is not an isolated event. It's the rule. It's not the exception. True unbiased news is probably 1%. The rest is people pushing their political thoughts. And those that control or have controlled for generations are really pissed off that alternative media has better audience than them. I am sorry to not be in groupthink, but I am not susceptible to this bullshit. And that isn't the only fake news story that I've personally witnessed. As a reporter, you know, I was involved in uncovering seven of the biggest scandals in Arizona history. In Arizona, you know, I kept getting pitched news stories about all of a sudden out of my phone just kept ringing like 3 weeks in a row. It was weird. It was like all these news stories about disabled people falling in public at restaurants that didn't have handicap accessibilities to the entrances or the bathrooms. I mean, I've got a big heart. I've got people I love that are handicapped, right? And I thought, geez, man, that's a story, but it happened at such an unnatural frequency that my spider senses went off. And so as I started to investigate and I started interviewing, and I really made the mistake of doing these interviews and telling these stories, but as I dug deeper and I found out that the person that was calling me or the three people that were calling me, they weren't from a disabled American outreach group. They were from a group that was called Protecting the Disabled Arizona or some made up thing like that. It makes your heart swell. Of course you want to help them. But as I started to dig in and look to see where these people really worked, they worked for the construction companies that redid entrances and bathrooms in Arizona. It's like a trade group that recognized that if they could create a big groundswell of people that just want to do good and help people, they could get a whole lot of contracts to redo every public bathroom and every entrance in the state, right? And as soon as you see the truth bubble to the surface, you become a little bit more jaded. Look, I've got this newspaper right here in my hand that is, I've kept it for 15 or 16 years, because this to me was the clearest, easiest evidence of fake news that I ever saw. And right before, about 60 days before 9/11, there was a news story in the Arizona Republic about the Arizona Cardinals Stadium. I worked on this story for a year straight. Probably knew it better than almost anybody. You should know the reason the Cardinal Stadium is in Glendale and not where the power brokers, the establishment, the money, and the Cardinals wanted it, which is Tempe, is because of me and my on-air partner, Charles Goyette. And the Arizona Cardinals and the city of Tempe, they wanted it right in Tempe where they could control it and it was in their cushy neighborhood. And the reason we knew where the site was going to be is because they had a fair and impartial site selection committee. Now, you'll find this interesting. How did we know which site they selected 40 days before they selected the Tempe location? All we did is we went down to the Arizona Department of Realty. We ran everybody's name on the Fair and Impartial Site Selection Committee, and every single one of those fuckers had property around one of the seven sites that they were looking at. Okay? This is how stupid the people are and how the power continuously pulls bullshit stories on them. So what we did is we held a fake groundbreaking ceremony at the location before the site was selected. We had a marching band. We had an NFL football player throw out the first Cardinal interception. We had cheerleaders, and we invited the media before the Cardinals could announce where the site was going to be. And when the media showed up, we handed them all packets implicating every member of the Fair and Impartial Site Selection Committee on that location, why they all have money to be made there, and how it's a scam. But what I'm really interested in is this newspaper in my hand, because the FAA, the Federal Aviation Association, declared the site a safety hazard because it was too close to the airport, okay? Directly underneath the flight path of Sky Harbor, the seventh busiest airport in the world, they were going to put a 13-story building, and planes would have a very hard time, according to the FAA, which to me is probably the right people to make that decision, and that stadium wasn't going to be safe. And you can see, I'm going to show it to Colin, who's in the room with me right now. Colin, you can see that on the edge of the plane's wings, they show the flight path, right? All the way down to the airport. This is in July. Remember, July 2001, leading up to September 11th. Then people were like, wait a minute, the FAA says that's not safe. We should probably think of a different site. But all the power brokers and the money had property. They had too much invested. They don't really care about your life. They want to become billionaires and put up hotels around the football stadium. So what they did is they shifted on the front page. Remember, on the front page in July, they put this photo of the stadium that wasn't safe. Then a month later, they put up another cover story where they moved the site from one part of the land to the other, and then they distorted the image. So now they aren't showing how it goes over. Do you see this? How the wings go over the same exact spot, but the newspaper, the Arizona Republic, and the Arizona Cardinals and the city of Tempe and all the are now saying, well, the site's safe now, right? And it's the same exact damn image. And they don't care if 70,000 people on a Sunday or a Monday night football or one of these stupid Thursday games where they wear obnoxious uniforms are going to be endangered, right? All of this is fake news. So preparing to give you my take on fake news, I researched the websites that Zuck and Google and the established media were interested in banning. And because they're horrible and less than 1% of the news is fake, and guess what I discovered? I discovered that an assistant professor in Massachusetts created this list of fake news websites, and amazingly, the sites list on there the names of conservative news sites that think differently than them, right? And they listed those sites as being, they should be banned. Remember, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I just care about truth. And I think competition is really important. You need to have competition of thought too, because it encourages quality. It encourages accountability. And when the powerful feels threatened, they often look for a crisis they can solve so they can also take care of their enemies and even their competition. Now, thanks to WikiLeaks, we discovered that 65 mainstream reporters whose campaign coverage constituted propaganda for the Clinton campaign, and they were providing them questions and asking them for questions that they should hammer the other campaign, all of them would then fit in the propaganda or fake news realm. And so as I've been thinking about this, I know people want to think, well, maybe we should censor, or maybe we should have a blue ribbon committee to determine what is news, right? The reality is, once you start creating a thought police, you start creating cancer inside of that media or inside of that news. I'll explain how I know that in a moment, and I know it to be true because it changed my life. But central planning and business decisions aren't the answer. What you really want to do is give people choice. I've never heard anyone say they're offended by being given a choice, right? A choice is an option. What works best for you, right? Let people choose. People never flip out when they're given a choice. You know, this isn't a Republican creation or a Democratic issue. It's how humans respond. Perfectly fine letting people like Google or Facebook or ABC, CBS News or whatever destroy their own business. That's their choice, right? But that's what Google and Facebook are doing right now when they're creating 50% of the country being their enemy. There are choices. An alternative Facebook will pop up. An alternative Google will pop up. And nobody should be so strong that that couldn't happen. Now, how do I know that when you start censoring, it becomes a cancer? The reason I know is I did it on my own. Some of you might know that my first website went crazy viral and we had 36 million unique visitors a year. And, you know, I allowed people because I'm not offended. There's sticks and stones. I'm a sticks and stones guy, right? They may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. In my site, when with that huge audience, I allowed people to post their own news and their own information and their own takes on these news stories. And eventually what happened is people were screaming out, Todd, you need to ban people. You need to censor people. These people were racist. So eventually I made the second to last decision I ever had to make on Phoenix News when I started censoring. The reason it was the second to last decision I had to make is because the last decision was to shut down the site. Because once you start censoring, you start favoring one side over the other. You start silencing voices. And before you know it, your whole audience is more interested in the censorship issue than the fake news issue. And when people start censoring, they become some type of a centrally planned authority that knows better than you. And it becomes clear that your business is starting to disintegrate because of that censorship cancer. When you don't give people a choice and you start to censor on their behalf, you end up eating away any credibility, any type of free expression that made your forum, your business, your social network so attractable. Don't make that mistake. And if you do, it's your own demise. Reddit vows to combat online abuse as CEO apologizes for editing Trump supporter comments. It's an interesting news story. Reddit CEO and co-founder Steve Huffman said Wednesday that the tech firm will be taking action against the social media site's most toxic users and apologizing for how we handle abusive comments hurled at him. And so it's really interesting, you know, a post on Reddit that they got involved in censoring. It's an example of what I just explained to you that before you know it, your audience is like, screw you guys. We can't express ourselves here. And now you're the big thought police. And it starts to deteriorate. It could kill a Google. It could kill a Facebook. It could easily kill a Reddit. And it becomes really super contagious. The San Jose Mercury News is reporting that Twitter faces more calls to suspend Donald Trump's account. Quote, by locking or suspending Donald Trump's account, Twitter can send a powerful message that hate is not acceptable or condoned on their platform. You know, it's really interesting. I'm not a Trump or a Hillary supporter. And from both sides, there seems to be an overabundance cry of people crying wolf right now. He's a Hitler, she's a crook, he's a racist, she's a pedophile, he's a Nazi, she's a Satanist, he hates people, she knocks people off. I mean, this is the conversation that people are having, and it reminds you of the story. Like, you remember the boy who cried wolf? The shepherd boy who repeatedly tricks nearby villagers into thinking that wolves are attacking his flock? When one wolf actually does disappear and the boy cries out to the villagers again for help? The villagers believe this is another false alarm, and the boy and the sheep are eaten by the wolf. You remember the story? There's so much crying wolf right now. What would we ever do if a real Nazi or a real pedophile took over, what would we really do? Be classy. Be classy, my friends. The world isn't going to come to an end. And there's and this is only a problem because we've grown our government's power to unhealthy levels, a government large enough and powerful enough to give you everything you need, is powerful enough to take everything you have, limit the size of that power, follow enumerated powers, like it says in the rule book. And before you know it, you won't be susceptible to somebody from the other party that you've demonized having any real effect on your life. Which brings me to the big topic of how long should a video be? You know, the golden rule of video length hasn't really changed. I want people to think about video this way. Tell enough of a message to deliver a really compelling story about your business, your product, your service, and don't go a second longer. I mean, that's the answer. Be as succinct as possible to tell a very compelling message. Don't go a second longer than that. However, you know, that's not a super helpful rubric. If, you know, just a way of deciding what to cut out of a video is a really important thing to look at. You know, you always want to be very succinct. So to help color in some of the details for our listeners, here are some of the other fundamentals about how long a video should be that you need to take into consideration. Longer videos perform better in search. Okay. And other content like webinars, video courses, YouTube videos, people opt in for longer videos. The reason it is has a larger perceived value. You can go in more depth. Video, like other content in search, is going to be evaluated by time on page. That's one of Google's primary ranking factors. Time on page. YouTube calls it watch time. Basically, the same thing in the Google algorithm, all right? Facebook also uses time on page as a search engine metric. So if somebody spends 10 minutes on a video, but your competitor has similar information and somebody spending 2 minutes, Google, Facebook, YouTube will look at watch time or time on page as their algorithm's way to look at quality. If the quality is there and people stay longer, they will move the longer one up. And it's important for you to understand, you know, these people have already demonstrated a high demand for your content. So you don't want to shortchange them. Give them all the goodies, but, you know, just be long. Don't just be long for the sake of being long. Give them really important information. You know, some topics can feel long in 90 seconds, while other videos may actually feel short in 2 minutes, right? I know I'm not directly answering your question, and it's by design. Every topic has a different amount of time to be explained. Fake news? Damn, I can't explain fake news in 90 seconds. I gotta unpack my world. Dude, you gotta know that I grew up Jackson. And you gotta hear that story because what's out in the public is always different than what's out in reality. Different stories take different amounts of time, okay? Refer back to the golden rule. Be as short and succinct as possible. Tell a very compelling message. Don't go a second longer. Now, shorter videos tend to perform better on discovery platforms where people stumble across content. And a discovery platform could be like, you know, a social media news feed. This is more of a hard, fast rule than a number one. You know, the number one rule that I gave you before, your content needs to be shorter in these discovery platforms like social networks. And if you have more to share, ask people to click on your website or YouTube to get the full meal deal, all right? You'll give them more information. As I said, full meal deal, my stomach growled. Awesome. Love that. Happy meal me now. And in a sales context, it's better to provide more options. Long form, all-in-one product walkthroughs and demonstrations for people who want to act fast and have the same information delivered in short chunks over a long period. Okay, so for people who need to be nurtured, that's where it's valuable. On your website, at the top of your sales funnel, remember, we start off in this podcast, we were talking about the buyer's journey, right? Same as the sales funnel. In the early stage, your videos, here's just a simple rule. In the early awareness stage, your videos should be shorter. And as your audience starts to demonstrate a higher level of interest and attention span, that's where your videos should be longer. All right. So an easy way to look at this is top of the funnel, shorter. And as somebody goes down the funnel, videos can be longer. All right. I hope that answers your question in the most compelling, succinct way possible. Look, for more information on this episode, just go to wirebuzz.com/52. That's where my Jackson Little League photo is. And I'm going to put up this, I'll put up this Arizona Republic story so you can see what it looks like when they want to be deceptive and provide fake news, because their advertisers, right, have a vested interest in that stadium site being where it is. You should see. It's really interesting. If you want to know where to get started with your business and what topics you should be creating first that are profitable for your business, all you have to do is download our free topic selection worksheet that we created, and you can get access to it. It's free to listeners of this podcast. You can access it at wirebuzz.com/topics with an S on the end, wirebuzz.com/topics. It's a great way to select the right videos that'll be profitable for your business. And if this podcast was valuable to you, I mean, if I provided information that makes you a smarter marketer, a better video marketer, by all means, subscribe to this podcast. And you can do that on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Please leave me an honest rating and review, because I learn from that. I want to learn and take your feedback and provide a better service. And behind the scenes, we're going to continue to do what we always do on your behalf. We're going to look for news and information that video marketing masters need to know to advance their business objectives. And we'll do it each and every week right here on Video Marketing Mastery.